Okay. Right, so we are looking at, Millie began talking about the temple, and so I thought it would be interesting to look at different aspects of the temple. And so one of the things that I did was I copied this book that I bought many years ago, which, as you see, is typed. And they've taken a diagram of the temple, which is actually the diagram that the Tiferet Yisrael commentary on the Mishnah, written over 100 years ago. But he prepared a very precise diagram of the temple. And so we have that diagram here. And there are letters in the diagram. And there's a key, which has been translated partly into English. So you actually have the whole key to the letters which indicate the different parts of the temple here. The only problem with it is that it's only partly translated into English. As you see, that there is a little phrase in Hebrew and then an explanation. But I think actually it does work, because whatever is put in Hebrew is actually translated. So it is really translated into English with a few little exceptions. You know, like it says Mizbeach in Hebrew instead of writing altar. So you might not understand that. So there's always a word or two which is in Hebrew. But the initial phrase is in Hebrew, and then there's a translation. And sadly, I don't remember who it was originally prepared this, but
it seems to be facing east, or seems to be facing west, or
it west. Mm. Yes, the temple faces west. In other words, as you walk into the temple, you're walking towards the west. The eastern gate is the gate where people come into the temple mostly, or that is the.
Through the woman's courtyard.
That's right, walking through the woman's courtyard. And the west is where the Holy of Holies is. And the west wall, you can see just at the top of the paper, is the outer wall of the temple precincts called the Har HaBayit, the temple mount. If you turn over the diagram, on the other side, it's on a... A wider perspective, you have the whole wall of the temple precinct, which is sacred. We can't go into this precinct just like that. One is supposed to be ritually pure, not have been near the dead, the ashes of the red heifer, similar concept. And this is the general area. And the west wall is up here at the top, which is actually the west of the picture. The east of the picture is at the bottom, and the west is at the top. So our western wall is here somewhere. There's discussion about exactly where. Is our western wall over here at this part? And so to the left, going through the archaeological walk that there is at the side of the Kotel, leads you to the area where the Holy of Holies is, which is what the guide tells you. Or do we follow another opinion? I think Rabbi Isaac Luria said that where we stand at the wall, in fact, that's where the Holy of Holies is. So according to his view.
Do you ever go into the tunnels?
Yes, well, a little
because
bit.
Because at some point the tunnel is right opposite what was supposed to be.
Well, that's what they say. That's their theory.
Yeah.
That's
what
Terry just said. That's what the guide tells you, but it's not necessarily accepted.
Whether it's definitely true, I don't know. there was a kind of a synagogue in that recess.
Oh dear.
I haven't really researched that whole area, properly, you know, the actual, you know, physical place. I've been on the guided tour, but the fact that there was a synagogue in that area would suggest it wasn't really the Holy of Holies. It's,
Well, I, in 1968, went there filming Israel Television, program on Tisha B'Av.
Right.
With Professor, what is the guy who wrote all the guidebooks? Very famous, not Vilnay, Zev. He did all the early Israel guidebooks that were the standard books. And we were interviewing him at the Robinson shop to get there. Now, of course, you have all the, we had to actually go up ladders, climb over the roofs of sunken buildings, and down to get to Wilson's Shaft and Robinson's Arch.
Right.
And it was very, very different to how it is today.
Right.
Who was the professor that did all the guidebooks, the Israeli guidebooks?
Was it Vilnai? No. Can't remember.
Zev
Vilnai. I think it was Zev Vilnai.
Interesting.
Maybe not, I don't remember.
Sorry, it was the one in the Khan that died.
I don't remember.
One of the comics, crowd.
All right, well, let's stay on this page, on this page which has got the bigger picture, the smaller scale, so that we're looking at a larger picture. Normally, we would enter the temple, I think, through this Shushan gate, down there at the bottom. There's the Shushan gate.
Yes.
And I think that there was a, it was called the Shushan gate because it had, just one second, now we've got this, let's see what it says in Gimel. Do you see this, Millie? Can you read this? Gimel?
Yeah.
If you want to keep... keep one finger on the gate. Do you see that, Gimel?
Sha'ar Shebamizrach?
Yes.
The gate in the east wall called the Shushan Gate in honor of the capital city of Persia, a picture of which was painted above this entrance.
Right, it was either a picture or some kind of relief design representing the city of Shushan.
Why?
Which is a very interesting concept. The simple political explanation is that they were building the second temple at the behest and with the permission of the Persian king.
Ah, yes.
So this refers to the second temple?
Yes.
Not the first?
Yes. We're looking here at a diagram of the second temple.
Oh, okay.
Now you see there are four temple structures described in Jewish texts. One is the prototype of the temple, which is called the Mishkan, the sanctuary, which is in the book of Exodus. And there's a lengthy section describing how it should be built, and then how they are going to build it, and then how they do build it. So that's one temple in Jewish texts. The next temple in Jewish texts is Solomon's temple, which is described in considerable detail in the Book of Kings. So the Book of Kings tells us about how King Solomon is going to build the temple, and then there is quite an extensive description of that temple, which is the first temple. So we call the one, the sanctuary built by Moses is called the sanctuary, the Mishkan. The first Mikdash, the first temple, is the Solomon's Temple, and that is and that is described in the Book of Kings. Then we have another description of a temple in the Bible. Does anyone know where? In the Bible.
No.
Well, it relates to the fact that the Jews were then taken into exile to Babylon. And while they were there, the temple was destroyed. And a great prophet of that time had a vision of the next temple, of the rebuilt temple. Who was the prophet?
In Babylon, Ezekiel?
Yes, that's right. So Ezekiel had a vision of the temple, of, as it were, the next temple. The temple's been destroyed, but there's going to be another temple. And it's a very dramatic vision. It's towards the end of the book of Ezekiel, and he is shown around the temple by an angel, and it's like a very mysterious description with measurements of huge gateways, and it's a very beautiful concept. However, when the Jews actually came back to the land of Israel from Babylon, now under Persian rule, and the Persian king decided to let them come back and build the temple, they looked at the text of Ezekiel and they couldn't quite understand it. So what they built was not quite what Ezekiel described. So we normally refer today to Ezekiel's description as the description of the third temple, which will be built in the future. Because when they built the second temple, which is what they built after coming back from Persia, it has some resemblance to that, some resemblance to the first temple, and a few bits added on. And so therefore the second temple has a character all of its own. Now the second temple is not described in detail in a biblical text. There were prophets at the time of the beginning of the building of the second temple, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, but they speak about the temple, but they don't describe it. However, the description we have is in the Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah was written when the temple was already destroyed, when the second temple was already destroyed. But it records discussions that people had earlier, and there were particular rabbis who had great knowledge of the temple, who had seen the temple, like a tradition from someone who had seen the temple, because the early sages, like Hillel, lived in the time of the temple. So we have the Mishnah in Tractate Midot presents a description of the temple. That's in the Mishnah. Then there is no Talmudic commentary on that Tractate Midot, but in Tractate Yuma, which talks about Yom Kippur, there is incidentally a lot of detail about the temple, because it's talking about the high priest and what is the service of the high priest on the Day of Atonement, and there was this feature of the temple building and that feature of the temple building. So therefore, when it comes to put together all this information, which, for example, Maimonides did in his Mishneh Torah, he wrote a text called The Laws of the Chosen House, Hilchot Beit HaBchira, and in that there is a very full description of the temple, drawing from Tractate Midot and Tractate Yoma and other places within the Talmud, so as to present a picture of the temple. And it's really on that that this diagram is based, these diagrams and the information that it has in it.
Do you have any idea to what extent it differs from the first temple?
Well, it's very obviously very different. For example, right at the beginning, there was only one courtyard in the first temple, and here there are two.
Right. So there wasn't.
That's an enormous difference.
Yeah. There was just one.
Yeah, it was just one. The first temple was much more like the sanctuary in the desert.
Probably smaller as well, then.
Yes. Yeah. The sanctuary in the desert. Well, it didn't have this part, so it was therefore small. The sanctuary in the desert was on a smaller scale altogether.
So, would I be correct by saying that originally there would be no area for women in the first one then?
You're right. I mean, this Ezrat Nashim, it's not only a place for women.
No, I didn't. You men are walking through to get into the temple, so they would be sitting in that area for a while, and they can come and go. But in relating to the first temple, wouldn't have had that mixed space.
you wouldn't have had that mixed space. No, in the first temple, there was no place for non-Kohanim to stand, except when they were actually offering, bringing an offering. Now, there is a gate over here. I think it's Gate Zion. Gate Zion. Let's have a look what it says about Zion.
So
wooden railing?
No. No, I couldn't.
Ezrat Nashim is you. That's what you want?
Looking for a gate in the holy section.
Yes. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe it's Mem Aleph. Let's just have a look at Mem Aleph.
It probably
this could be a board
shape. Shah Korban.
Right. Look at that. Mem Aleph with Mem Bet. Okay. So, Michael, would you like to read? Have you got that? Mem Aleph?
Here, done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mem Aleph.
Shara Karvan?
Korban.
The gate of the offering through which
Kodshe Kadoshim.
Kodshe Kadoshim offerings were brought.
Right, and read the next one.
Shar Hanashim, the women's gate, an entrance for women bringing offerings.
Right, so that's Mem Aleph and Mem Beit. Let's see if we can find that in the diagram. You see, wait a minute, we can look at the bigger diagram. We'll have that more clearly.
Mem Nun is right in the center, above the Great Sanhedrin.
Mem Gimel. That's Mem Gimel.
What is this not?
The dogs.
Sorry, I forgot about that.
Mem Aleph is where they brought the offerings. And Mem Beit. Now, in this diagram, I tried to make this diagram more understandable by putting English words on it. But where it says golden altar, that is covering the Mem Beit. And Mem Beit is where is the gate where the women would stand in order to bring an offering. So very often women would come to the temple, and in fact, it talks about droves of women coming to the temple, because there were two types of offering brought. One is a public offering brought on behalf of the entire Jewish people, which was a lamb in the morning and a lamb in the afternoon, and on Shabbat, extra offerings, and Rosh Chodesh, extra offerings, or a festival. But that was the basic public offering that everyone was involved in. Everyone would give half a shekel a year in order to pay for these public offerings. But the other kind of offering that was brought was a personal offering. So if a woman had a baby, she would bring an offering to the temple. And those were the most common offerings in the temple. So if she was richer, she would bring a lamb, I think. And if she was poorer, she would bring two doves. And so that was the commonest kind of offering in the temple, these two doves. And also, of course, there were other festive offerings like the Paschal lamb and things like that, which were like personal offerings that a person brings on the festival.
It's, can I bring you some water?
No, I'm fine. Yeah, thank you. So that's where the women would stand. Now, in the time of the first temple, they probably had a similar arrangement that they would come over there in the first temple. You just think about the top half of the diagram. And the women would stand over here in the same way in order to bring their offerings. And now, whether men would actually enter, I mean, there is a, you see, this part is the Ezrat Nashim in the second temple, where men and women could be there. But it had a feature which relates to what is called the Ezrat Nashim today in a modern synagogue, is that during the Sukkot festival, there would be very joyful dancing in this Ezrat Nashim.
Well, you also had the music rooms, didn't you?
There were places where music...
Thank you, Alan.
Sorry to be late. Hello, Tadi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Finally, when did you come back?
Oh, yesterday.
Yesterday.
You like it, sir?
We are looking at the temple.
What have you got on your shoes?
What?
Those pink sparkles.
Nothing special.
Well, he's just come from school, can't you see?
From this village.
Let's see if we can find Kaf. Letter Kaf as the
Lishkat
in
Chasa Malbish.
Where? Kaf is here, next to the Great Sanhedrin.
Wait a minute.
Can't be.
Kaf Chet, Kaf Lamed. The Kaf.
On the left hand side of the Great Sanhedrin.
Yeah, Kaf and Kaf Aleph.
Look at Yud Zayin. Now, the question is where is Yud Zayin in the picture?
Yud Aleph, no?
In the diagram.
Yeah, in the diagram. I think it's written in a funny way. To be honest. You see, I think what they've done...
I think it's next to the Kaf, but it's not written properly.
It's Yud Hey.
What do you look? Yud Aleph?
No, Yud Zayin. You know what I think they've done? They put Yud on one side and Zayin on the other. I think... Because there is already somewhere else there's a Zayin. And so look at what it says, Yud Zayin. As, you see over here there's a Zayin.
Yeah. On the other side there is also a Zayin.
Yeah.
Right.
No, you've got Yud Zayin here. Yud Zayin.
Yeah, because Zayin is a generic thing. It's a certain kind of gate. Or so now this Yud Zayin is on either side of these steps.
Oh,
now, so would you like to read what it says, Yud Zayin, in the key? No, in the text with the picture, you also have a key to all the details in the picture. So Yud Zayin, Shtei Lishachot. Yeah, go on.
Entrance to the two rooms under the Azarat Israel, where musical instruments were kept and the musicians and choir practiced.
Right. So there you have rooms which went under the... You see, it's sloping. The it's on a mountain. It's on a hill, right? So it's sloping. So this area, when you go into this area, it's flat. But then there are 15 steps... going up. These 15 steps correspond to the 15 a text, famous text, said very often. Shir
Hama'alot.
There are 15 psalms which begin with the word Shir Hama'alot, Song of the Steps,
in the Book of Psalms.
And so those 15 psalms relate to the musical ceremony that took place at a certain time, also in the Sukkot festival, going up with the procession slowly going up these steps, carrying water, which is going to be used in the next day's service at the Mizbeach, at the altar. So this going up the steps with this water... They would sing these 15 psalms, and the 15 psalms maybe were used at other times as well. So at the side, so that means if you're going up 15 steps, that the second courtyard is higher, considerably higher than the first one. Mm-hmm. So what it told us just now, what you just read, is that, that Shaul just read, is that underneath the courtyard is a hall, are two halls. And in those two chambers, and in those rooms, would be kept the musical instruments, and the Levites would practice there. What an image. what a graphic, a graphic image. Now, of course, we do not know exactly what kind of melodies were sung. I've heard it said that Gregorian chant is supposed to have some kind of affinity to the temple singing, because, of course, that was something that people heard, and then that was a Jewish mode of singing. There is a tradition about a particular Chabad melody that it was sung in the temple. I haven't been able to find the source for this tradition. I've heard the tradition, I've heard it said orally, but I haven't found a written source for it. And it might be that the melody was prophetically conceived, as it were, in the 19th century. But the person who conceived it might have been the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, felt that this melody was sung in the temple. So I'm going to sing you a little bit of this melody. It's a cascading melody. It's very interesting because it doesn't fit neatly into any musical tradition. It's quite an interesting melody.
Without words?
Well, this in Chabad is used as the melody for Birkat Kohanim. The blessings of the priests are sung to this melody. The Chazan sings it, and then the Kohanim repeat it, and it's a very beautiful experience.
You mean Yivarech Hacham?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they sing this, and then they end off, Yivarech Hacham, ay, 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 ay. It's a hypnotic melody. Usually sung outside Israel on festivals when there's Birkat Kohanim. Inside Israel, where there's Birkat Kohanim every day, they just say Yivarech Hacham. But this sort of slow, it is a very, very beautiful thing. It's a very beautiful. I don't know, maybe on a festival in Israel they also say it in a slower way. But that might, you know, I think of that as something like the kind of melody that would be played by the Levites.
So the Levim used to sing it, and they're using it for the Kohanim.
Yes, it's interesting. In fact, there are a number of interchanges between Kohanim and Levim. For example, the place where the Levim would stand when they sang, that as you walk through up these 15 steps and through this gate, which is called Shar Nicanor, the Gate of Nicanor. So coming, let's just see if it tells us anything about that.
Does it have a meaning, or is it just a name? Is that a word?
It's the name of a man. It's the name of a donor, actually. Oh. Let's look at Yudchet in the...
Would you like in the middle?
Shal Mizrahi? Yeah. Have you got Yudchet? It's on page 3.
Two small doorways. Yeah, the east gate.
Go on, read it.
The east gate, the gate of Nicanor, was named for the man who noted the brass doors of the gate.
Right, and then it gives a reference to the Talmud. See, Yoma Lamedchet. So
it sounds like a Jewish name.
It sounds Greek.
It does, doesn't it? Mm, Nicanor, yes.
But the Greeks weren't there yet.
Yeah,
but the process of
Hellenization
started long before.
Let's have
but the point is, what are we talking about? 6th century?
What, BCE?
Yeah.
No, much later.
Much later.
Oh, when?
It's the second temple.
Yeah. Let me have a look at Yuma Lamedchet.
It's a common era with your time of Christ.
1660.
No, but
built. Before, yeah.
It was built before.
Because you talk about the gates, and they were would have been in the early period of when it was built.
Yeah, but it wasn't hundreds of years before Christ. I mean, it was a century preceding him.
One only?
What, maybe Nicanor was
one? No, a few centuries. You've got the whole... I'm just trying to find over here. Yuma. What page did it say?
Lamedchet.
Lamedchet. I'm a bit slow today. My eyes hurt.
No, it's just like.
Yeah, that's right. Lamedchet. No, it doesn't say.
Greek. You look like you come from a Greek mafia or something.
No.
Didn't he look like a GI?
Small is innocent than
no, he looks like one of our members, an elderly guy named Jack Steinberg, who's dresses, I mean, most appalling.
Have you seen his
mustache? Oh, I see. Now I see my eyes.
The mustache, the mustache.
You have a new feature.
Yeah, I know. I keep changing all the time. And I'm going gay, as you suggested.
It says over here, our sages learnt many miracles were performed for the doors of Nicanor. When he went to bring these gates from Alexandria in Egypt, and he was bringing them back in a ship, and there was a storm in the sea, and which threatened to sink the ship. And the sailors said, we're going to have to throw these gates overboard. They threw one of the gates overboard. It was very heavy. And the sea was still raging. And the ship was still in danger. So they decided to throw the second gate overboard. Nicanor stood up. He couldn't bear it. And he wrapped himself round the gate. He said, throw me into the sea with it. At once the storm stopped. Miyad nachayam, example. And he was terribly upset about the first gate. If only he had done that with the first gate, he would have saved those gates. Right? So when the ship came to the port at Akko, they discovered that the first gate that they'd thrown overboard had got stuck under the ship, and they brought it. They brought it. After all, they hadn't lost it. So
it doesn't tell us when.
When?
Yeah.
No, I would imagine.
No, but if it talks about Alexandria, then it was after Alexander the Great.
Yeah, but certainly after Alexander the Great, I would imagine that it's after the Hanukkah miracle.
Okay.
It's in the time of the rebuilding and the restructuring
second,
of the
second
temple.
Second century.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes. Well, first or second century BC.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
in which case, Nicanor,
a typical date for the Hanukkah is 165 BCE. So...
Yeah.
If we take that as the date of Hanukkah, so it would be after that,
yeah.
And or in the first century.
So Nicanor as a Hellenized
yes,
Hellenized name,
yes,
is then
like many other
common
people, yes,
like Afikoman.
Yeah, or like
Josephus Flavius.
No, that's a Greek. That's a Roman.
That's a Roman. That's right.
Like Androgynos.
Androgynos. I just wanted to, just one second. I just wanted to see what it says in the Mishnah. Hold on. Okay. Anyway, so that's this gate of there. You see, can look up anywhere in the Talmud, and it'll actually give you a translation as well.
Is it online or do you have it downloaded?
No, it's downloaded. See, here it is in English. Only sometimes it gives the wrong page. See, nothing is.
So you have the entire Mishnah over there?
The entire Talmud.
Wow.
Yeah, but nothing is perfect. Just
is that the translation?
It gives the wrong English page.
but
no one knows. Alright, so there we have this. We're going through this gate of Nicanor, and we come into Kaf Bet. Now this Kaf Bet area, that's a narrow area. It's actually 11 cubits. That area is 11 cubits, and that is where the people would come when they were bringing certain kinds of offerings. Let's just see what it says in the description over here. Lily, it's your turn. Would you like to read up there?
On top of 4.
Yeah, on top of page 4.
Ezrat Israel. The court of the Israelite, 11 amot by 135 amot, beyond which ordinary Jews would not go unless necessary.
Right. So in other words,
amot is a measure.
Yeah. Now it's 135 amot is the length. It's the width of the whole structure.
Which is nearly the width. Oh, no, it's not the width.
Well, one amot is about half a meter.
Okay.
So that's something like
135 is about 60 meters.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
quite
16,
big. It's quite big.
Or 60,
it's quite a large structure.
66
meters.
Yeah.
Very large.
Wow. By 5.
Well, it's quite big.
66 by 5. 11 or
more. Oh, 11, yeah.
Roughly.
That's right. So this area is. And so people.
Square meters.
So people could come up into there in order to take part in something to do with the offerings of the Kohanim. I'm not quite sure, actually. You see, you've then got these steps upwards. Now let's see, this is where the Levites would stand on Kaf Dalad and Kaf Hay. Now Kaf Dalad and Kaf Hay is on the same page. Kaf Hay.
Did you say they were actually Duhan stairs?
Yes, they're steps.
This one, Duhan.
Yeah, would you like to do that Kaf Hay? A stage.
Duchan, a stage with 3 steps on which
the Levites.
Yeah, stood facing the sanctuary, the backs of the people, while singing. From the Duchan, and that's where Duchanin comes from.
Now that's the interesting thing. Duchanin is what the priests do, the Kohanim. Right. But the word Duchan, you're absolutely right, but the word Duchan is here for what the Levites do.
Right.
So the Levites would stand on that long, thin platform.
To the Mizbeach were 11.
Another 11 cubits, Amot.
Amot, which was
Ezra Kohanim. Yeah, this is English. English and Hebrew mixed together. The alternative is to write the English in Hebrew letters. That's what happens in Yiddish. You write German in Hebrew letters, and occasionally you have a Hebrew word.
Or Russian.
Yes, that's right. So here it's English mixed with Hebrew. Sorry, what did you say, Shaul?
What did you say about Dukhan before?
So the Dukhan is a kind of stage. It's a narrow stage. And the Levites would stand on the stage, and he says here, with their backs to the audience. The audience is behind them. The audience is over here. But it depends who you think the audience is. If the audience is the visitors to the temple who are crowded over here, then they've got their backs to the audience. But if what is really happening is inside the temple, then they are actually facing where the action is, because there you have the altar and then the holy part and the holy of holies, and they are singing into that space.
Is that your translation? Is that audience rather than the congregation? Or?
Well, you see, these words, whether we say audience or congregation, we're adapting words from different kinds of situations. The temple was not a synagogue. So we talk about congregations in a synagogue. The temple was a place where services took place, but in a quite different way to what happens in a synagogue, even though the synagogue, so in a sense it's more like a
show. It's just like a show.
I think of it as a show, because if you imagine something like Yom Kippur, people would mass in this area, and a very good viewing point. Can you tell me what it was? To see what was going on in the temple?
On the walls.
No, I don't think they would climb the walls, but there was a very good point. Har HaTzofim.
Yes, of course.
Har HaTzofim, the yes. Viewing mountain.
Mountain, yes.
It's a mountain just next, a hill, just next to the temple hill. Yes. And by standing on the temple, on the viewing hill, Har HaTzofim, which is now where the Hebrew University is.
But how
the Har HaTzofim campus.
Is mentioned in the holy books as such?
Har HaTzofim is mentioned in the Talmud. What, you think the Hebrew University began the concept?
It started with a hospital.
No, that's where they founded the university in 1925.
That's right. But in the middle there is another.
And it's beautiful. I mean, the synagogue in the Har HaTzofim campus. You are actually, the arc of the synagogue is like in the middle, and then you've got two windows on either side of the arc. And the two windows, you're looking right into the place of the temple, like beyond the Kotel.
You mean right on the Dome of the Rock?
That's right.
So it was the only show in town then?
Well, it was an amazing show. Yes, and I think of this as something where you had packed people coming to watch what is happening. In fact, I think it's very likely from descriptions we have in the Talmud. Like if the Kohen Gadol appeared, everyone would start like looking at him and following him. They treated him like people today treat some great media personality or something, and they would follow him. In fact, there's one interesting moment that the Talmud records, that the high priest was being followed by a whole crowd of people, and suddenly two people who were of even greater glamour came into view, which were Shmaya and Avtalion, who were two great sages of that time, the leading sages. And the whole crowd left the high priest and began following Shmaya and Avtalion. And the high priest was very cut up about this. And he said something. He stems from Aaron HaKohen. You know, the Jews are very much into Yichus, genealogy. So he is a priest. He is a direct descendant of Aaron, the brother of Moses. Shmaya and Avtalion are famous because they were both children of proselytes to Judaism. So they came from, in Jewish Yichus terms, humble origins. And nonetheless, everyone found them more glamorous because they were the great Torah sages of the time. So you see, the Talmud is giving this in order to show that Torah study, Torah knowledge is more important than genealogy. But you see, incidentally, what a dramatic mode people were living in, that the high priest was something glamorous and the Torah scholar was something glamorous. And so there's no doubt to me that the ceremonies, the services which took place in the temple were a media focus. And so that's why I think of it in terms of audience rather than congregation.
So Shmaya and Naftali were celebrities.
Sorry?
They were celebrities. Yeah.
They were celebrities.
And we know them, of course, from the famous story of Hillel, who was not allowed for some reasons to inside the Beit Midrash to hear their speeches, their sermons.
He couldn't.
Was listening to them on the roof.
Yeah, just today, I happened to study this with a group of friends. He couldn't get into the study house because he had to pay to get into the study house. So they charged, academic institutions are £9,000
a
term.
It was a business, you had to pay fees. Huh?
That's right. You know, it's an interesting thing that you had to pay fees. You couldn't pay. In those days, they would not pay a rabbi for teaching. Paying a rabbi for teaching was a later concept, and you're really not paying him for teaching. You're paying him to compensation for not doing some other job that he would do when he's not teaching. That's so
expensive.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, so, but nonetheless, there were overheads of the study house, I assume. And so they charged half a dinar a day. A dinar was a small coin. And Hillel earned one dinar a day. And he used half of the dinar to pay for his and his wife and children's livelihood.
Nigel.
And the other half to get into the study house. So it shows that they had quite high fees. If it's the same amount as is needed to run a family for a day. Yeah. Hi, Nigel.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Take care. So if the amount of money you need to get into the temple is to get into the study house is the same amount as you need to pay for living, to run a family for a day, it's quite
so
a considerable amount.
According to what you say, Torah learning was the privilege of the rich at the time.
Well, Hillel was poor.
Yeah.
But he managed to. Many people were poor.
No, why pay at all? That's the question.
It's an interesting question, and I don't remember seeing an explanation of it. There might well be a commentary on that very passage, which is in Yuma, in Tractate Yuma, around page 21, which may well. There may be some commentary discussing what was the function of this payment.
Mm-hmm. Who are ordinary Jews who were not allowed into the Azara? Are they those who are neither Kohen nor Levi?
No. Oh, you mean, ordinary Jews could come into this into this area, and they could come up through the gate of Nicanor, up to the stage where the Levites would stand with their musical instruments, but they couldn't come past there. On the other hand, they could come to these gateways when they were bringing an offering. So if someone was bringing a personal offering. Now there was something called smicha.
Yeah, but they would still wait outside. They wouldn't be allowed in the gate.
Not actually in. Because past this Dukhan, past the stage where the Levites would stand, is like a more sacred area where only Kohanim, and in fact that's part of the whole concept of the temple, is increasing levels of sanctity. So just in order to get into the outer courtyards, one has to be ritually pure.
Yeah.
A person who's been near the dead, which is what we consider any of us, because we walk through the street outside and who knows who's buried underneath. So we need to be cleansed by, purified by the ashes of the red heifer before we can cross this wall. So that's why here is the west wall, Nigel, you see. This area, that's the west wall in Jerusalem. And we stand the other side of it. And But normally a Jew is not supposed to cross over this wall. I mean, they have sometimes. So this is an area of one level of sanctity. Then there's the Ezrat Nashim, the women's courtyard, which is sort of more inwards. And then climbing up those steps and going further in. And then is the place where only the Kohanim go. And then we come to a more inner sanctum. So we've got the altar over here.
Yeah, only for the Kohanim.
Yeah, now this is an area only for the Kohanim. And then we have several steps, three steps over here, in front of the Ulam, the hall of the Kodesh, of the actual Heichal, the actual the inner temple structure. And that's where the Kohanim would stand and give their blessing to the Jewish people. We're using the divine name, so they would call out their blessing. And then there is the inner part over here. Now this is an enclosed part. Outside, there's no roof. So all of this area, there's no roof. One is just in the open air. But as we come in here, it actually is enclosed. It's 40 cubits high, and there's a roof. And there is this large hallway with a wide entrance, which is never closed. And then there is a gate, a door, or a whole series of doors, and one goes into the sacred area, which is called the Kodesh, before the Kodesh Kodoshim, the final point within, which is 20 cubits square, that is 10 meters square, that's the Holy of Holies. But before that, we're in the outer holy part, which is enclosed, and the illumination which is there comes from
menorah.
Yeah, there's the menorah. There were certain kind of windows, actually. It did have windows. And the idea is that a spiritual light would shine out of it. But as Millie says, on the left, as you come in, on the left, there is the seven-branch menorah made of gold. And on the right, there is a table with 12, a golden table with 12 loaves of bread, which was there, a kind of hard matzah-like bread, like thick matzah, which remained there the whole week. It was put there on Shabbat, and it remained till the next Shabbat. And there were also little files of incense, two files of incense on the table. And there was also a golden altar. And on this golden altar, only incense was burnt. So this was a very fragrant area. And one enters. Now, a priest could enter this area. And then there's the Kodesh Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies. And the Holy of Holies can only be entered by the high priest, and that only once a year. On Yom Kippur. Yes.
Do we know what was the floor like? Is it mentioned anywhere?
Yes, I mean, for the most part, the floor was marble.
So it would have been marble.
Yeah, outside it was marble. And if a marble slab was in some way broken, then or rocking, this was a problem. You know, like it had to be sort of a very perfect, very very perfect structure. And in fact, they walked. The Kohanim walked with bare feet.
Yeah.
To wear shoes would be considered as if you.
We only in the Holy of Holies.
No, in the whole area.
What happened about during slaughtering time? We spoke about this previously. It was just covered to a foot in blood.
Well, it might have been a bit messy.
Full of footprints.
Well, they
would, in they, certain section, not the whole, not all of it.
Yeah, they would wash it. You know,
they've got drainage. I remember that.
Yes.
We went through the drainage areas, but still.
And I just the vision of that floor. So if it was marble, it doesn't mention if it's black, white, or squares. One assumes it's marble. Or is there a description of the actual floor?
I don't remember a description of what color the floor is. But there was a kind of fascia on the actual building of this heichal, which was like strips of marble, alternate blue and white. How the JNF got the same idea. But it was alternate strips of blue and white marble. So it looked, which were uneven. So they were slightly recessed. So it looked like waves. It's described as looking like the sea. It looked like a wave.
I've never seen a blue marble. Would it be Persian blue, maybe very deep blue?
Tali, where would the Holy of the Holies be? On the Moriah Mount, on the Temple Mount, today, in relation to the mosques?
Right, we spoke about this before. It's not sure. You know, I mean, one opinion is that the Al-Aqsa Mosque itself is...
But Al-Aqsa is too much on the edge, Al-Aqsa. So it could not be there.
It's on the left.
Yeah, but...
The Dome of the Rock.
The Al-Aqsa is one mosque and the Dome of the Rock is another.
No, so wait a minute. It's the Dome of the Rock.
Dome of the Rock, yeah.
The Dome of the Rock. Some people
which
think...
Which one with the golden...
The golden is the Dome of the Rock.
Yeah
that's...
Al-Aqsa is the silver.
Right, so there's the idea that the Dome of the Rock, that rock, was something to do with the Holy of Holies.
Yeah.
But there's no description of a rock of that size.
Yeah.
There is what is called the Eben Shtiyah, so that's where you get the similarity. The rock of the foundation rock, the foundation stone. But the sages talk about the foundation stone as a thin slab, a three-finger-breadth high slab. And on that slab in the first temple had been the ark, the golden ark. But that golden ark was missing from the second temple. And then one comes through the... Now, do you see in the passage from the holy part to the Holy of Holies... Nigel, do you want to look at this?
Sorry.
Look at the bigger picture.
The bigger on the other.
Yeah, on the other side.
Sorry.
How does the high priest get into the Holy of Holies? There were two curtains, and he had to go in on the left. Walk between the two curtains and then come out at the other side, and now he's in the Holy of Holies. Right? So there, in that realm, there we are in the Holy of Holies. And so that is the point of greatest sanctity.
The Holy of the Holies was on the same spot in both temples?
That's what the sages believe. Yeah. And in fact, this is a crucial issue for rebuilding the temple. Funny enough, they don't talk about the Holy of Holies as being the issue. They talk about the site of the altar. The altar is the place from which the earth was taken to create Adam and Eve. So there's something very significant about having exactly that spot. All right, so this is...
So the Holy of Holies is more symbolic, where the altar is very important.
Well, both are very significant.
But where Abraham was about to slaughter his son.
That's true as well, yes. That's where Abraham was about to slaughter Isaac. And that was, of course, Solomon's temple as well was there. You know, so it's got a whole chain. Adam offered offerings at that spot. Noah offered offerings at that spot. So it's got this sanctity going back through the generation. Now, this concept of this building and the structure of the building, there are many different ways in which one can look at it. One can look at it all as a structure within the person, that there is a kind of a psychological structure of the temple within oneself and the different levels of the temple and coming in. In fact, the Piasechna Rebbe, who was a rabbi, a Hasidic Rebbe who died in the Warsaw Ghetto, he wrote a book which he taught the idea of imagining, when you're praying, imagining that you're in the temple and sort of learning the details about the temple, and imagine that you're walking through and you're walking up these steps and you're coming here and then you're going, you know, step by step, going further and further in till you get into the Holy of Holies at the intensity of the Amida prayer. That's, you know, as if one is entering the temple of one's own heart. So that's a very powerful image. But now I'd be grateful if we could look at the other text that I brought, which is talking about the Kabbalistic significance of the temple. Now this is from Tanya. Yeah. Do you have one?
Chapter 52.
Now we're looking at we're looking on page 273, 274.
Yeah.
Now I think let's focus on the English. So first of all, we're talking here about the Shekhinah. And the Shekhinah, but as for the Shekhinah itself, the manifestation, I'm missing out some words, I'm paraphrasing. But do you see where I'm reading?
Yes, it's right at the top.
The manifestation whereby the blessed Ein Sof, that means the infinite, illuminates the worlds in a revealed form, and which is the source of all streams of vitality in all the worlds. So we're talking here about some kind of focus, the way in which this Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, gives life to the worlds. Now, he uses, earlier on, an image of a person and the brain of a person. The way in which the brain in a person's skull is the focus of the life and energy of the whole body. And really, everything else that is happening in the body is dependent on the brain. And it's the energy in the brain which is then somehow channeled through the different parts of the body, the different limbs, the different organs. But really the brain is the initial focus. Now the metaphor, or the comparison that he is presenting, is that to understand what the Holy of Holies is, we would consider the Holy of Holies as a form of brain of existence, where divine energy, which is giving life to everything, is concentrated in the Holy of Holies, and then from the Holy of Holies it spreads round the entire world. So it's like the brain of an organism where there's the brain at the some kind of central point, and from that central point, that energy spreads everywhere.
The nerve center.
Yes. Now, the point is that the Shekhinah, this divine radiance, which is so intense, how can it dwell there? The worlds, do you see where I'm reading? The worlds cannot endure or receive the light of the Shekhinah without a garment to screen and conceal its light from them. There has to be some kind of concealment because the intensity is so powerful. And if you didn't have a garment, a veil, which is hiding the radiance of the Shekhinah, then the worlds would be dissolved away. They would be nullified. So then we move down to where there's a little black triangle. But what is this garment which is able to conceal and clothe the Shekhinah and will not be completely nullified? In other words, what can conceal the divine presence? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a Kabbalistic sleight of hand, if you like. The will of God. It's a concept called the will of God. When God says in the Torah, do this, don't do that, that's the will of God. The will of God is that aspect of God which is godliness itself, but it somehow translates itself into the world. It says a person shouldn't do this and should do that. It's got a tangible dimension. That is able to be the veil of the infinite presence of the Shekhinah. Now, what is the will of God? The will of God is there in the Torah, and in a more essential form, in the Ten Commandments. What was in the Holy of Holies, originally in the first temple?
The Ten Commandments.
The two blocks of stone in the golden ark, and in those blocks of stone, engraved on the blocks of stone, are the Ten Commandments. And the sages tell us there was also a Torah scroll there as well. So there was a Torah scroll in the Holy of Holies. That expression of the will of God is the kind of covering, the veil, which is able to maintain the Shekhinah, the divine presence. So that's really the Holy of Holies. Going towards the Holy of Holies is going not just into a place of infinite awe, but it's also a place where the command from God emanates. And in fact, if we go back to the prototype of the temple, the sanctuary in the desert, Moses would go into the holy place. I mean, we could look at the same diagram. It was much less complex. But he would go into the holy place, and God would speak to him from between the two wings of the cherubs on top of the golden ark. So, and that was what he wrote down in the Torah. So there is this divine communication coming from within the Holy of Holies.
Behind the curtain.
Yes, from behind the curtain.
This would be in Ormoed in the desert.
Yes, that's right. Yes, in the desert. So there we are in this realm where there is the quality of the Shekhinah, which is somehow enclosed in the will of the divine. Now, the will of the divine is Keter. It's Keter. So now, if we go over the page to page 275. So he's speaking of the way in which the Shekhinah goes lower and lower. Oh, one second, I'm sorry. If we stay on page 273 for a second, and you've got a circle and a triangle.
Yes.
This wisdom came down by the sense. Sorry, have you got it? Where there's a circle and a triangle, page 273.
Yeah.
This wisdom came down by the sense from world to world. That's the wisdom of God, the will and wisdom of God. And thus enabled the Shekhinah to come down as well and clothe itself in each world. That's the Kabbalistic concept of different worlds. This is the shrine of the Holy of Holies, which is contained in each world. So we could talk about the Holy of Holies in the world of Atzilut, in the world of creation, in the world of formation, and so on. There is, at every level, there is a Holy of Holies, which is the point where wisdom is enclosing the divine presence, the Shekhinah. And so that is, so in other words, Chochmah, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, the higher Sfirot, those three higher Sfirot, those three higher divine attributes, that's the Holy of Holies in an exalted supernal realm. But as you come down step after step, then we go on to the next page. And he says that from a certain level, you've got the source of the wisdom of the Talmud. And then there's... So he gives a whole explanation that there is the quality, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. He keeps using this word, Chabad. Chabad means wisdom, it's an acronym for wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Now, at that level, that's where the Talmud emanates from. Because the Talmud is the interpretation, the explanations of the law, which is the will of God. You see, so you've got this interface between the intensity of God and the will of God. The intensity of divine revelation, clothed by the will of the divine. Now, if I could share with you a completely personal perspective that I had many, many years ago, actually quoting a Greek myth. We have the story of a Greek hero, I think it was Perseus, and he is trying to fight with the Medusa. Now, the problem with the Medusa is that anyone who looks at the Medusa gets turned to stone.
Petrified.
Yes, petrified, yes. And if you remember, the Medusa is like a head with all serpents emanating from it. Yeah. So how is he going to fight with the Medusa, do you remember? That's right.
His
shield is a mirror. And he looks at the mirror, and by looking at the mirror, this doesn't turn him to stone. He can see the Medusa well enough to be able to stab with his sword, and he's not turned to stone. Now, going back many years, considering the way in which man confronts the infinite, the neon, and the way in which a common response is to be turned to stone. And we express this in various ways through art and other aspects of inner crisis. What is the shield, the shining mirror, which enables us to relate to this void, this infinite neon, without being turned to stone? As God says, Lo yirani ha'adam b'chai, man cannot see me and live, says in the book of Exodus. The Torah, the will of God. The Torah is the beautiful mirror which enables us to contain the intensity of the divine. And that's really what it's saying here. That in the Holy of Holies, there is a kind of containment of the intensity of the divine in such a way that it is expressed and contained through the Ten Commandments, the Torah, the will, the teachings of God. Then when you come down to a certain level, that's where the Talmud emanates with all the discussion of the halachot, so of the laws. And so therefore we have the way in which there is a kind of nurturing of the very essence of the divine in the Holy of Holies, and that is also the source of teaching and of wisdom. And so with that little insight, we can come back to our picture of the temple, of the actual temple as it was in Jerusalem. And there is an interesting structure that we come to. In fact, if we look at the Temple Mount, and we are walking into the Temple Mount from this gate, the Shushan Gate that we had before, with the picture or the embossed relief of the city of Shushan in Persia, the capital of Persia at that time, we walk through the gate. What's immediately on our right?
Small Sanhedrin.
Small Sanhedrin. Yes. A law court. Ki mitzion tetze Torah. From Zion, from the temple, from the very crux of the intensity of God's presence in the world and among the Jewish people, comes law. There is the Sanhedrin, what is called the small Sanhedrin. Now they use, conveniently, the Tiferet Yisrael, who was drawing this diagram over 100 years ago, he used this image to represent the Sanhedrin, because they sat in a kind of a semicircle. So because of that, there were 23 people, 23 judges in the small Sanhedrin. So we walk further, and we come through this eastern gate here, and we walk into the Ezrat Nashim. What do we have there on our right?
Another one.
Another Sanhedrin. That's the second Sanhedrin. Also the small Sanhedrin. And then we go along, we go in, and we go up the steps.
And you have the great Sanhedrin.
And we have the great Sanhedrin. That's right. The great Sanhedrin is there in the actual more sacred part of the temple. And that is the high court, so to speak.
70, I think.
70, that's right. Yes. And that is the high, that's the highest court of legislation, administering Torah law.
And yet they're in the same presence of the levies, because that's the room of the levies.
Where the Levites,
the
the Levites stand on the stand on this thing, and the Sanhedrin is in a chamber called Lishkat HaGazit, the hewn chamber, and so there was a law court with 70 rabbis there, and they would be discussing whatever issue has come up,
and then they wrote the Septuagint.
Sorry.
And then they wrote the Septuagint.
No. That, it Much sounds better. Good, but the Septuagint was, the story goes, it was organized by King Ptolemy in Alexandria.
All right.
And he got 70 rabbis, and he asked them to write down in Greek what the Torah is saying, and he put them in separate cubicles, because he didn't trust them. He thought they would write something different. So by having 70, he would get a... he'd be able to compare the text. Miraculously, although they did change some things, they all in unison changed. So, which proves they had mobile phone.
What, for instance, did they change?
I think, I've never looked at this, you know, in terms of what the Septuagint actually says, but... I think one of the things the Talmud says is it says Bereshit bara Elokim. It sounds as if something is creating God. So they changed it to God created Bereshit. You know, like the God created the beginning.
Elokim
bara Bereshit.
There would be no confusion.
Yeah, that's right. So various points where it could be misinterpreted. Mm. So I mean that's an interesting. Study. So that's the Septuagint. So it's different to the 70 stages of the Sanhedrin. But it is a fascinating thing. In fact, I think the Friday night of this week or next week talks about the Septuagint. It's maybe next week. So the Friday night that I write, it discusses this little discussion of the Seder of the Week that I put out. So I think it's next week's talks about the Septuagint. So,
there's still a question why he chose 70.
Yes.
So maybe it's some relationship.
Well, it might relate to the concept of the Sanhedrin. It's course, Napoleon, he organized in 1808, Napoleon gathered 70 rabbis,
yes,
with the idea that they would reform Judaism according to the new ideas of the Enlightenment and the Revolution.
Isn't it fascinating that they all pick up 70? Yeah. Both of them, those big things.
And he did this, and he addressed 12 questions to the Sanhedrin. It's Napoleon who's asking the questions. So one of his questions was, does a Jew have to fight for his country? That's easy. Yes, of course. You know, the Mishnah says, pray for the peace of your country and pray for the government. Yes, yeah, fine. But another question wasn't so easy. Can a Jew marry a non-Jew? And it's Napoleon asking the question. So what do you say?
Not tonight, Josephine.
Well, what they wrote is, yes, but a rabbi cannot officiate.
That's very clever.
I thought so.
That's smart. Gosh,
yes. Yeah, yeah. So there we have this structure of the Holy of Holies as the source of law and of teaching and of guidance. And the point is that the temple may be destroyed, as it is at the moment, but in spiritual terms, that structure still remains. And although the temple buildings are not there, the Torah is, and the Talmud, and the teaching. So therefore one is able to have that contact with the divine through the Torah and its teachings and the mitzvah. However, ultimately the goal is that the temple itself should be rebuilt. And then there will be the kind of physical, psycho-spiritual and physical transformation of existence that would lead to the rebuilding of the temple in each person's heart. Right. That the presence of the divine will be there in everyone's heart as well. That instead of our heart being the way it's depicted, covered by a kind of a foreskin, covered by a kind of leathery canopy, which doesn't allow the heart to feel. And if that could be removed, then the heart feels in a genuine way. It feels in spiritual terms. And so that's the rebuilding of the temple, literally the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem, and the rehabilitation of the hearts of man.
Historically, it was a real catastrophe, and it happened a second time. And Jews were then scattered in the four corners of the earth.
In order to create little corners of spirituality.
Exactly.
And a mikdash ma'at, a little temple.
Yeah.
Mini temples all over the world.
And that's how I see it, and I always did, that it's a divine plan, that's what we were supposed to do, sprout the rest of the universe, the world. Therefore, this whole concept of mourning for 3 weeks from the days that they broke into the wall, and I kind of want to understand why. Obviously, this was something that was instituted later on.
Well, it's mentioned in the Tanakh. It's when they began rebuilding the second temple. Someone comes with a shaila, with a question. I think it's to Haggai. Haggai is one of the three prophets who were around at the time of the Second Temple. And they asked him, should we still fast on the 17th of Tammuz and on the 9th of Av? And he gives them a very ambiguous answer, which you can't actually work out what he's saying. Well, I can't work out what he's saying. You know, it probably remained an ambiguous issue because the Second Temple did not have the glory in certain ways of the First Temple. It didn't have the intensity of the divine presence the way it was in the first temple. It didn't have the luchot, the tablets of stone, the golden ark, so various other things were missing. So, but the point about grief, I mean, this is the paradox of life. It's very often there are negative things that happen. From those negative things, positive things emerge. But you have to be, you still have to grieve for the negative. Even though a positive thing emerges, and indeed that is the divine plan, it's like death itself. You know, God forbid, the age of 120 or 180, you know, given a bit of inflation. An old man passes away, and his spiritual and physical heritage is passed to his children. And, you know, in fact, if you look at it over a 20-year period, what happens next? It's all positive things. This wisdom that he bequeathed to his children is now spread in different corners. And nonetheless, the fact that he passed away, so you miss having this great and special person.
I'm not disputing that, and I understand that, and a day of mourning is appropriate, but a day of mourning, and I could never understood why it has to linger for 3 weeks of mourning, because that
Well, that's just a little bit more complicated. I mean, so Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, is the real focus. Chassidim did not take the mourning on, or do not take the mourning on Tisha B'Av so seriously. I think the people who really enjoy mourning are the Yekas, the German Jews. Mm. They invest a lot into this sort of mourning.
Chassidim don't fast on Tisha B'Av?
They fast, They do fast. But there are stories, what happens very often in Hasidic synagogues on the day of Tisha B'Av is that it's just the right season for this. The children go down to the river, which in Stamford Hill is the River Lee, and they collect gorse burrs. And then they come back into shul, where everyone is sitting, saying, like for hours and hours, reading the kinot, the lamentation, and then Eicha, lamentation.
On the floor.
And they throw, sitting on the floor, that's right, on little stools. And they throw gorse burrs at people. Now, if you've got a beard, a gorse burr is quite an issue.
Well, what's the reason for that?
It's, I've never seen anyone like analyzing this in an article, but it's a very widespread thing, and I think it has to do with a kind of Hasidic
humor.
Yeah, it's diluting the grief of Tisha B'Av. I once spent Tisha B'Av with the Gera Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael in Jerusalem, great figure, and. There, like, there's a whole book of kinot, of mourning poems. And they would read a kinah, and then another kinah, and then the Rebbe would turn the pages, very obviously, like, turn 10, 20 pages, and they would read, and everyone laughed, and they would read another one or two. And the whole thing was, you know, instead of 3 hours, you know. And they would quickly stop that and get back to learning Gemara, you know. Yeah, and there was an exultant atmosphere. It was not at all grief. It was and with the Beis Yisrael, it was a great Hasidic Rebbe. It wasn't at all a grieving. I didn't understand it at that time. I thought, why aren't people miserable?
Tali, what was the Rebbe's position towards visiting or praying in the Temple Mount?
On the Temple Mount?
Yes, forbidden.
Well, all Orthodox leadership, including the Lubavitcher Rebbe and all other Rebbeim, are against going into the Temple Mount. In other words, against going over this wall.
Not even to some parts on the margin.
anything that one can identify as being this area, one is not allowed.
You have to be purified to go.
Yeah, one has to be purified to go into.
But I know, and I know a lot of very Orthodox people actually go up, and they fight to go up. I mean, this is their daily tackle sometimes with the police, with the wakf, to actually
remember these
have a presence there, and it's usually Orthodox people.
Some of them, they're more nationalistic. The Israeli.
Yeah, it's chief. Like Gush. I don't know if it's Gush Emunim or something.
But by Goren at the time, he kosherized.
He gave a hetzer.
He measured the boundaries of the Israelis, and he said, outside it you can go, but
right.
Not inside.
Okay, so. Listen, it's there are lots of very often in life, and especially in Jewish life with Jewish teaching, you know, you get different issues conflicting with each other. You know, on the one hand you want to establish a Jewish presence, and on the other hand you've got the concept of ritual purity. Yeah, so it's you know, so there are collisions, you know, and how you deal with the collisions. That's
so. How about the concept of burial? Because you may have heard about the funeral of the Jewish singer Amy Winehouse.
Right.
So they had a ceremony in a Jewish cemetery, and they cremated her.
Well, I think that's very sad.
And I got stuck in the traffic jam. Who blamed?
You see, that's
but that's. Why? Well, I was at the cremation at the. One of the members at the Gulf of his wife, the Edgware Reform, and it's a very common practice to have to be cremated.
Yeah, and,
well, when you look at cremation began in Germany around 1880. It's a German invention. And to be honest, the line that leads from the crematoria of 1880, which was like a clever way of disposing of bodies and not using up valuable land, leads to the crematoria of 1942. It's a straight line. And I don't...
Yeah. So it originated in Germany?
Yes, it was a German invention. Funny enough, the British took it up immediately. They also thought it was a very good idea.
Because I visited the Hopland Cemetery the other day, and I saw a big Jewish Hall of Remembrance inside.
Yeah. It's a reformed thing. Yeah, I was once trying to persuade someone not to have a relative cremated, and so I looked into the details of what happens during cremation. It's not pretty.
But the ban of cremation is not mentioned in the holy books, as far as I know. I mean, I know ashes to ashes, ma'afar batar la'afar teshuv, but it's not in the Bible. It's not in the Torah.
Look, there's a lot. It's not in the Torah, but it's like many other things are not in the Torah. But it's very clear in the Mishnah that burial is the Jewish mode of disposing of a body, and there is a whole tradition of how the body is buried and many things to do with that. And when cremation began in Germany, that was the point. Outside, like, you know, if someone did that, they were really outside the pale as far as Judaism was concerned. That was absolutely outside. And, you know, they faced the problems. What do you do with a family where they've cremated their grandfather and now they want to come along to the synagogue, you know, and say Kaddish for him? So what do you do? You know, so this was the kind of things that rabbis were discussing.
Well, you know, there was the Orthodox lady who tried to get special dispensation from the chief rabbi to be cremated. Why? Because she wanted ashes sprinkled over Brent Cross so her daughters she'd know would come see her 3 times a week.
Oh my God, stop it.
No, I would not worry about that.